Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, welcome to the 400th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Mike Slane. I'm Matt Enloe.
And I'm Warren Kaplan. And yeah, like Matt said, we are on episode 400. Crazy that we got here. Can you guess right now how many episodes we'll do in our lifetime?
I wouldn't wager a prediction. A better question is like, what would it take to get us to stop?
I've noticed that on script notes recently, Craig Mazin has skipped a bunch of episodes, and I'm assuming it's because he's making super busy.
Yeah, a TV show or something, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I guess that's, I think, what would make us stop if we were both, like, literally in another country for 2 years working on a huge project or something.
I mean, speaking of script notes, John did move to France for a year.
And he kept doing the podcast.
Kept doing the podcast, yeah. 400 episodes deep. You know, I think, like, we're always looking for ways to help challenge ourselves. You know, like, it's pretty special to get to, like, talk about the thing you love so much once a week, guaranteed. You know, people don't have that very much. Thanks for listening, everyone. If it didn't feel like anyone was listening, it would be hard. And also, frankly, thanks to your listens, we've been able to get some really incredible guests. So thanks for sticking around, everyone. More live shows to come, more cool guests, more introspective navel gazing from yours truly.
You know, we've learned a lot over 400 episodes. Not only have we learned from our guests, we've also learned from our own trial and error as directors, filmmakers, writers, producers. We wanted to share some of the things that we've changed our mind on.
Or doubled down on.
We'll see how it unfolds. We've made a list of some things to bring up. But before that, I'd love to hear, Matt, what have you been working on lately?
Yeah, thanks. We're recording this November 26th. Couple days before the episode releases, so the end of the year is within sight, and I've got a lot of big plans for this next year and then years beyond, and I've talked about on the show many times, and I'm sure we'll talk about on our year in review panel episode coming up. We always do that right around New Year's, give or take a week. Talk about my goals. I'm big on setting goals, and there's this guy I've been following on TikTok. He sells a calendar that he calls the Big Ass Calendar. Have you seen this guy?
No.
He's kind of like a energetic guy in his mid-50s who's just like, hey, listen, I'm getting up there. I want to have an incredible year. I'm a really organized guy. This is how I do it. And basically, he's made the same video over and over again, but I think it really resonates with me. His point is like, look, if you don't plan to have an awesome year, don't plan to hit your goals, you're not gonna. And so he has a big calendar, and he like puts all of the different marathons that he wants to run and the big trips that he wants to take and all of that stuff. And his point is like, work will fill in the gaps. He doesn't need to plan for work. He needs to plan to adventure, to make time for his family, for the big monumental thing. I agree with all of that. I'm not going to go out and run a marathon, but like, it does force you to ask yourself, like, oh, what would be the things that I wanted to do in a year to make it truly awesome, to make it really special and memorable and you know, make life worth living and all that stuff. And part of that, being an artist, means that you have to kind of plan your slate, your projects out a little bit. And I know I've talked about this a lot on the show. and have felt a little unmoored these last few years, frankly. Like, a lot of big life changes, the pandemic, weird stuff with the industry, the strike, everything's feeling, had felt really crazy, and I feel like things are kind of finally back under our feet a little bit. Industry-wise, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, all of that stuff. I started looking at my 2024, and I realized that the trick to all of this is to look at those big lofty goals and just figure out how do you slice that up into something tangible? You know, how do you say, okay, well, I want to make a movie. How do you make that a reality? Right. So we're at to talent currently.
On your feature.
On my feature. Yeah. As a for instance. I want to move. I want to do all of these things. Like, how many jobs is that? How many jobs do I need to think about booking in the next calendar year in order to hit financial goals, for instance? You can say, oh, I want to make X number of dollars in a year, or I need to make X more dollars in a year, or whatever it is. But if you say, okay, based off of my day rate and how many months there are in a year, how many months I plan on working, how many tangible jobs do I really need? Is that realistic? Is that feasible? I could say, oh, I want to make $1 million next year. You know, it's probably not going to happen, right? But if you do the math and it's very simple, I think you can start like having realistic, but still very ambitious goals that you have a shot at achieving, at attaining, basically.
So you're saying do the math.
Do the math. Yeah, basically. And then it made me feel really better, well, a lot better, frankly, because I think, you know, there's a couple different ways that I could hit my financial goals next year. But if you say, oh, I want to make $250,000 next year, as a for instance, it's a lot of money, right? But how many jobs is that? How many jobs a month is that? Can you hit that or not? Is a much easier pill to swallow, goal to hit. That's actionable, right? Like our conversation with Tom Morris is an easy example of like, how many seeds do you need to plant in general to book, say, 2 jobs a month versus 8 jobs a month? 8 jobs a month, probably not going to happen realistically, right? So that's really what I'm trying to say is like, I feel better knowing that the goals that I'm setting for myself are feasible, if not ambitious. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, a little bit. There's an actor I follow on Instagram that I work with. She's very talented and she works a ton. She's always posting like screenshots from her phone of texts mm-hmm. she gets from her agents. Hey, booked it. You're on a veil, mm-hmm. pinned, you know. And I sent her a message on Instagram. I was like, geez, how many jobs do you book a month? You're just like booking nonstop. And she wrote, she's like, I aim for 4 jobs a month. Mm-hmm. And she's an actor, right? So it's different, obviously, than a filmmaker. But I was like, what do you mean aim for 4? Why don't you aim for 20 jobs? Like, mm-hmm. what do you mean you can't aim for these jobs? It's like, I play the lottery and I aim to win this many times. I mean, I guess maybe that's a more mm-hmm. a more predictable thing. But like as a freelancer, you don't know. Some months it's like everyone wants to work with you and other months nobody wants to work with you.
There's a difference between setting a goal that's crazy town. If Oren, I was like, hey, Oren, I'm going to make $100 million next year. And I was like, well, it's going to be on directing alone. That's how I'm going to make that $100 million. You could be like, okay, well, let me do a little bit of math. If you booked a job every single day of the year, your day rate would have to be, what is that?
Yeah, 30 grand or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, $100 million?
$100 million.
Oh, like $3 million, yeah.
Yeah, right? So,
Sorry, 300,000.
Is that realistic then?
No, but it's realistic to make $1 million and it's also realistic to make $10,000.
Like, sure,
like,
sure.
The range is still big just because you came out with some ridiculous
number.
But
what do you have to do? What do you have to do to make $1 million? Right? I'm not saying that I'm going to hit this. For sure. But like knowing what you would need to do knowing what your batting average is, how many jobs you typically have to pitch on in order to book one, right? What the rate is, who's pitching, all of that stuff is part of it, right? So it's easy to just be like, well, I just want to make as much money as I possibly can. But that's nebulous, right? Like, of course that's true. And we're not just talking about money. I'm talking about all sorts of other things. I need to write another movie. I need to make a movie. Like, there's a lot of other life goals that all fit into this matrix. I'm just talking about this one part. But so if you can take a big picture look at like, oh, this is what I want to happen in 5 years, in 4 years, these are life achievements and goals and my path, basically, and you can slice it up, A, you can tell whether or not it's realistic, and B, you just know what you're aiming for. And I think that is a pretty huge part of the process. I talk about it on the show all the time. Part of the fun of filmmaking for me is putting a plan into action and executing it. And so for me personally, just hoping to make as much money as I can is just a lot harder to execute on than having personal goals.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, maybe money is a little bit too specific of a goal, but like our friend Roxy, who's been on the podcast many times, says it's hard to reach your goals without knowing what your goals are. Mm-hmm. And it gets easier to reach your goals if you tell people what your goals are.
Yeah, sure, for sure. And like making movies or writing movies are easy examples, right? You know, if it's 100 pages to a first draft and I want to do it in 3 months, then I know how many pages I need to write. And like if I come in at 2 pages one day, I need to make up the difference on the next. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, it's been helpful and it's felt really good. And also, it reminds you of how much you need to get done when you're feeling ambitious, you know? And so those days when you're not feeling great, you know, you can just put in the numbers and call it a day, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Oren.
Yes.
What have you been working on lately?
I have been, so, you know, they kind of say, like, as a freelancer, and I think this applies to all freelancers, but obviously we're filmmaking freelancers, you kind of have this dream that the longer you're in this business, the better you'll get at saying no to jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if a job's like not that interesting to you or doesn't pay that well or isn't at a great location or whatever it is. And you kind of think like, well, the longer I do this, the more I'll be turning down jobs. Mm-hmm. Instead of like hunting for jobs, you know. And I'm here to say from my experience, it's definitely not true. Like right now I'm pitching on like 5 jobs. And they're all these tiny jobs that I'm not that interested in, that I wish I could be like, sorry, not going to pitch on this because I've got this awesome thing going on,
mm-hmm.
but I don't. And it's just so cyclical. It just reminds me how this industry ebbs and flows and you can have these highs and you have these lows. So yeah, I'm pitching on all this stuff. It's, you know, end of November. A lot of it shoots in December.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like people are like spending like a few hundred grand here or there, mm-hmm. to finish off some budgets or make some social media bullcrap videos. I don't know. Anyhow, so yeah, I've been doing that. I'm still working on my scripted podcast. We're doing another draft of the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watching a lot of YA shows. I just started watching this show, Sex Education, on Netflix.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Really enjoying it.
I think I maybe endorsed it like mid-pandemic. It's good.
Yeah, it could be. Also, I went to a birthday party last night. I have friends of a certain...
Oh, an adult birthday party.
An adult birthday party, a karaoke party.
Mm-hmm.
And a good friend of mine from way back in the day was there. And we were talking about the midlife crisis he's going through.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I'm just not interested in what I do. After 20 years or however long he's been doing it, I'm just bored, you know, and I don't know what, like, there's nothing for me to do. Mm-hmm. And I was explaining to him the cycle of like the filmmaker and you know, you and I haven't talked about it for like a couple of years, I think, but we used to talk about it all the time, where you get a project, you're super excited about it, you figure out a way to get it made, you make it, you're in post, you put it out into the world, you're trying to get people to watch it, marketing, all that stuff. And then you have to go back to, then you have to figure out what the next project is. And you go into this inspiration phase.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my pitch, Sam. I was like, why don't you like, just
fill the well.
Spend 2 days on YouTube, just watching things totally unrelated to what you do. Like watch tutorials, go to museums, you know, go on a trip, do like, try, like do construction in your house or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try it. And it was funny because I was reaching deep into my memories as a person who was like trying to get inspired. Because right now I'm a little bit more like on the defense, just constantly stressed out that I owe someone something. It kind of reminds me of when I was in college. Like I was always behind on homework and studying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel like that's my life now. I'm at any moment, I'm disappointing 5 or 6 people who are waiting on something for me. Anyhow, enough about that. Let's talk about some filmmaking truths that we have learned and unlearned.
Right after we talk about our Patreon. Patreon.com/JustShootItPod. Look, we've been doing this for 400 episodes. Give us a buck or two, please. So we can keep going. We did just give Noah a raise.
Yeah. So we need more patronage.
You know, the show continues thanks to your support.
Patreon.com/JustShootItPod. Check it out. We appreciate it. That's all we got to say about that.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
What the heck have we learned over 400 episodes?
Well, my first one is very much something that we've learned over these episodes. Mm-hmm. And I've actually just talked about this exact thing on 2 other podcasts, and I'm excited to talk about it on our podcast.
Finally.
This is something I've heard my entire career, and it is that everyone has their own path to making it in this business.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that when you move to Hollywood, you try to schedule some meetings with someone that you met, or you've a friend of a friend, or someone that you're trying to get advice from. And you're like, hey, what should I do? I want to be a director. I want to work in film.
Yeah, they say you have to find your own path. And that's because they know that it worked a certain way for them, right? You know, even Jim on our live show said, like, when we asked about breaking in stories, he told his story, but he knew that it wouldn't be entirely replicable because of his circumstances and all of that stuff.
I've come to the conclusion that that's not true. It is, you know, with everything that we talk about today, there it is and it isn't. But as a whole, I think of this as less true than it is true. I think people say that everyone has their own path because they're like, well, you know, I went to a party and I met this woman who recommended that I talk to her sister who happened to work at the company that got me the internship. Right.
And it's lousy advice to be like, go to a party and meet the right person. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, I gave a horrible example because that is usually that example.
It's actually pretty good advice. Go to a party is pretty good advice.
Yes.
Actually. Yeah.
But we have noticed after interviewing so many filmmakers. Well, what do you think? Do you agree with me?
I 100% agree. We already talked about this. Frankly, this is the best piece of advice in the episode. You could stop after this.
Yeah. So what happens is basically every single person that we've seen become successful has connected with other film people in the industry, however they do it, whether...
No, it's even simpler. In the macro, every single person, I'm just quoting you,
right.
Every single person made something and showed it to someone else. That is the path.
Yes.
That's it. Just shoot it, show it to people.
Yeah.
That is the commonality.
Yes. And that plus perseverance, right? Keep making, keep showing.
Mm-hmm.
It's every single person, the people that we talk to that are showrunners, that are, you know, producer directors on major network television shows, that have directed studio films, that own their own companies, that do documentary series for Showtime. They all did the exact same thing, which is that they made something and they showed it to people. Not one of them just like had it met someone at a party and was given $1 million to direct something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They all, every single one of them made something and showed it to someone. And so while yes, everyone has their own version of that, I do think that like trying to work your way up in the ranks, trying to meet the right people, trying to schmooze, trying to go to the right parties, all that stuff is super valuable. But only in that it gives you people to show the stuff you make to. And if you don't have that, you can put it on Instagram and you can put it on Facebook or TikTok or whatever, wherever you connect with the most people or your local film festival. But in general, everyone's path is pretty similar. And my path was like that. I made YouTube videos and I showed them to people until somebody let me direct a tiny web show for them. And that I showed that to way more people than the network that made the web show showed it to. And that got me another web show and a job full-time directing at Disney. But it's only because I just kept making things. And in between all those things, I kept making more YouTube videos and showing them. And during COVID, I made Instagram videos with my kids and I put them online, and sometimes they led to work, but a lot of times they led to like, oh, hey, I remember that you are a director.
How you doing? Yeah, for sure.
That was cool. Let's talk about something. So anyhow, that's my thing. Everyone's path is pretty much the same. And so now you know what to do. Just go do it.
Yeah. We've been repeating ourselves for 400 episodes.
One other thing to add on this is it seems really hard to figure out what to make and to show to people, but it doesn't really matter. Just make stuff and show it to you. Copy a scene you like and show it to people. Like, do whatever you're interested in at the time. And remember, this is just one thing you're making in the course of thousands of things that you'll make.
So this next one, again, you know, I've kind of talked about this offline, but I think we have a greater
disparity.
Thank you. On this one, but so it's two different sayings, kind of in the same category. One is you have to direct a feature to be taken seriously
in the feature world.
In the feature world, and also people want to see that you can handle a budget and a crew. Oren, I want you to go first because I have thoughts on this.
Right.
And I think they kind of boil down to more or less the same thing.
Right. So the reason I really like this one is because you and I have talked about features for a long time, and I do think we fall on opposite sides of this a little bit. I truly think that serious financiers that understand how to sell things and how to make things that mm-hmm. they're interested in, like when they tell you that they don't want to work with you because you haven't made a feature before, because they haven't seen that you can handle a big budget or a big crew, I think that is an excuse for them saying that they just aren't interested in your project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my reasoning is that a lot of people have made features and worked with big budgets and big crews. And those people are not getting to direct, you know, all these features that are using that excuse, you know, or mm-hmm, aren't getting their projects greenlit, aren't attaching these huge producers or huge actors. And we know many examples of people whose first features have been pretty big and pretty successful off of a short, mm-hmm. or, you know, we talk about Damien Chazelle and like the Whiplash short. Basically, you see that short and you see him and you're like, absolutely, here's the money for the feature. Like, there's no doubt in your mind that when something is, and I apologize for this word, that's kind of become annoying to me, but when something is undeniable,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter if you've made a $100 million movie or not. Like, you look at Gareth Edwards, who made Monsters for no money by himself, was the DP and everything. And then off that movie, he got like Godzilla or whatever his next movie
was. I think it was Godzilla.
And then Star Wars. Like, I mean, no one was like, we don't know if you can work with a 1,000-person crew. Like, that does not matter.
Yeah. I think I don't want to quibble about those two examples, because I think maybe those, it would be easy to argue the counter, actually, in both of those instances. Like, why did Damien Chazelle have to shoot a short, and Gareth Edwards did have to shoot a feature in order to prove that he could do a studio feature? But the point, your initial point, I think, is 100% right.
Well, but all I'm saying is, off the short, he got the feature. It's not that he had to do a $100,000 feature to get a bigger feature. And Gareth Edwards didn't have to have a 1,000-person crew to get a 1,000-person crew.
Again, I think these are just two like anecdotal examples that I think it doesn't matter. We agree is what I'm trying to say. The bottom line is that these are two phrases that people use to let you down easy, right? Like going in another direction. And it's rough because, and this is the reason I wanted to go second, I literally have heard these, like, he hasn't done a feature yet, excuses from people in the last 2 months. Recently, yeah. I've heard this an established director who's making things, right?
And I've heard people say these as truths, like other filmmakers, like, yeah, well, no one's going to make my feature because I have never made a feature.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's maybe the big takeaway. Is if you internalize that, if you take that to be truth, then you're chasing something false instead of just going out and making your movie. I mean, I've heard versions of this my whole career, and almost always from the same handful of executives. And then at a certain point, I was just like, oh, they just don't dig what I do. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And that the flip side, people who were excited about you, people who see your work and get it, connect with it, they're never asking for credentials. They're creating opportunities with you. You're off to the races, you're running. And so, like, the gift maybe is that, like, these excuses are an opportunity for you not to work with the person you shouldn't be working with, or a company that you shouldn't be working with in the first place. That's the bottom line, for sure.
Yeah, that if it's the right fit and the right chemistry, that your resume isn't going to be what makes them decide. And I do hear a lot of people, especially kind of younger filmmakers, think that it doesn't matter what the feature is. They just need to have a feature on their resume. And it actually does matter. And if you had an amazing Oscar-winning short, that would be worth 10 times more than a super crappy feature.
It'd be 1 times more, actually. It'd be plus 1 more, because a crappy feature is worth zero.
Nothing.
Yeah, and I think, like, to your previous examples that I was giving you a hard time about,
more similar examples.
Yeah, for sure. That's not to say that there aren't, even if you're established, it's still hard to get a feature made. And so sometimes you do need to convince people to show them, to make it undeniable, right? Like the reason that you shoot a short as a proof of concept is to connect the dots for people, for them to understand. And that's not about the resume. That's about getting people excited about your creative. And that can be a lookbook, that could be, you know, an audio play version, that could be a short, that could be a rip-a-matic, that could be your reel. There's all sorts of different ways to do that. Or that could be shooting a feature that you know you can hit out of the park on a budget in a creative way and doing it yourself, right? Like the Whiplash had a proof of concept, you know, Godzilla had an incredible breakout indie feature. Like I was teasing you, those are both versions of how to be taken seriously, right? But your point is exactly right. It's not, let's look up somebody's IMDb. It's like, oh my God, have you seen this short? Have you read the screenplay? This is incredible. This is our person.
And that plus the conversation, your pitch,
sure,
your personality,
sure,
right?
And yeah.
So something that I do think is true is, let's say you've written and sold all these big Hollywood scripts, but you've never directed even a short film. I think it might be a little hard to go to an executive and say, hey, let me direct this next movie.
Sure.
Without them even seeing you direct a short. They just need to see you talk about shot and composition and performances.
You know, and maybe sometimes I think they need to have seen a short. Actually, I can think of a handful of examples, even of people that we've talked to on the show, where like they did need to prove it, but that's not the same as
making an indie feature.
Making an indie feature. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think I've told the story before that I worked with David Benioff when he directed a short film, because he had, you know, now he's known as the creator of Game of Thrones and very successful thing. But at the time, he had just written all these big Hollywood movies, but never directed anything. And he wanted to direct a movie. And Warner Brothers was like, well, you got to direct a short first. You got to be on set and say action before we give you, you know, $100 million. Also, he was writing very expensive movies.
Sure, sure.
So they're a big risk. But anyhow, so that's it. I'd love to hear what people think about it, because it is something that many people that you and I both know have said to me personally, like, yeah, I just gotta get this feature under my belt. And then watch out, Hollywood.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. A director needs a vision.
Yes. So longtime listeners of the podcast will know that word vision kind of reminds me of like the word fiance. It's just like a word people don't like to say out loud.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you feel pretentious.
Mm-hmm. I stopped doing the bit, but there was a long time where I would go, my vision, as like my riff on being a pretentious, precocious, precious director.
Right. I used to work full time, you know, for this company Window Seat, where we would make commercials. I was like in-house and they would be like, Orin, can you just tell us what your vision is? And I'd be like, don't call it my vision.
I think it's a little more triggering for you than it is for me.
Yeah. So I always thought like, look, I'm just the director. You know, someone has a script, an actor's bringing a performance, production designer's doing the art direction. Mm-hmm. There's a cinematographer that's helping choose lenses and figure out lighting. Like my vision, like as if I'm some, you know, like, auteur. And I think even on the podcast a few years ago, I talked about maybe like a Tarantino or a Wes Anderson or someone like that has a vision, but the journey people, directors are a little bit more like, hey, we're a team. It's like you're more like the quarterback of your football team than the, you know, all-knowing God.
Sure, sure.
Now, this is something that my point of view has changed on. I still don't love the word vision, but I've come to realize over the last couple of years, even like really over the last year, like, of course, we always knew that as a filmmaker, you should have a thing, a specialty, like something that you do that you love that people come to you for, you know. But I just realized more and more that this like word.
Are you confusing voice and vision?
Well, so
or conflating them?
No. I guess I'm saying they're similar. They're on similar places. Yeah. But so we all know you need a voice, but But having a vision I've now kind of come to terms with is, to me, a vision is like the combination of voice, understanding the goal for what you're making, whether it's a feature film, an episode of TV, or a commercial or a short film, understanding what you're making, what your voice is, and the ability to communicate and excite people about that thing. So to me, like you as the director,
just to I want to make sure that we're on the same page here and that listeners are tracking it as well. The way I see it, voice is the umbrella term for everything that I have made that has a cohesive idea behind it. Everything is a little meta in love. That's my
kind of like your
right?
style.
And your vision is project specific.
Yes.
So my vision for the project is what I mean to say. So if that's a Pepsi commercial, my vision for this Pepsi commercial, you know, is filtered through my voice, but is still a work for hire gig, for instance.
Yeah. And so for a Pepsi commercial, just making things up, let's say my vision for that is like, have I ever been felt like I'm just so tired and so out of it and just want to get in bed and not interact with the world and it's hot and muggy outside and I just drink something like it so cold and refreshing that it kind of gives me like a new lease on life that just gets me so excited. Like I want to capture that feeling in this commercial. And we're going to have a black and white sunny day, you know, and these people are going to drink these Pepsis and they're going to become humongous and run across the landscape or whatever. And whatever it is, like whatever your idea is, it's just being able to talk about it in a way that gets people thinking and excited. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you're not choosing the camera and the lenses and the fabrics and the colors of this building, but you are saying the things to the production designer, to the, you know, costume stylist, to the cinematographer, that's getting them aligned with what you're doing and capturing this like exciting moment. And
there's a term that we use a little bit on the show, and I'm calling it now. 2024, 2025, people are going to really start cringing, but because we're not there yet, North Star.
Oh yeah, overused this year. Yeah.
But I don't think it's jumped the shark yet, so to speak.
Yeah,
I think you can still use it. You're not like, oh boy. But so North Star, right? It basically, what's the lens? What's the thing we can look to? What's the idea we can look to? The vision where we can calibrate. We can say that we have this idea. We have this shirt. We have this element. Does it match up to? Does it follow the North Star or does it not? Is it in line with what we're aiming for? Is what you're talking about.
And obviously North Star comes from navigating towards this spot. Yeah, it's funny. I use North Star usually as a reference. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, and the North Star is like, it'll feel like a Tim and Eric sketch, you know? I feel like for more original kind of bespoke voice pieces, maybe I would use that less because my North Star maybe would be more of a feeling, right?
Yeah, which I think is right. I think it's, that's what made me think of it in this conversation. Again, I think it boils down to there's a lot of ideas out there, and the director's job is to sort the ideas that are in line with what you're trying to make and the ones that aren't. And it's not about good ideas or bad ideas. It's just what matches the vision for the project.
Now I'm 100% sold on the vision and this idea that as a director, you need to come in and you need to communicate that vision to everyone else on your team. And that's what makes you a good director.
I think this is just a vocabulary problem because I think that you always felt that way. And maybe I think that the evolution, honestly, is that you and I have both learned from our 400 guests, give or take, to be more forthright about it. That like initially when you're younger, you want to be a team player. And then slowly you realize that your job is to help people understand what they need to be doing and to be excited for it and to be inspired by it. And that is a different version of being a team player. You're the leader of the team.
Yeah. And you need to infect your keys with your passion and ideas so that they can run with them. Yeah. And I think it does take a few years to go from the person that knows exactly every single thing they want and is just constantly disappointed with the people that aren't executing it that
mind
way.
Readers. Yeah.
Yeah. To the person that is like, realizes they're not in control of anything and just kind of gives up and is like, I don't know, just they want a house and just make a house, you know?
Yeah.
To the person that realizes it's all about that kernel of excitement and how you can pass that on. Mm-hmm. And we had Micah Fitzsermon Blue on the podcast a couple of years ago. He's a writer on Transparent, and he wrote Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and he has a show on Netflix called Painkillers right now. But he said to us at the time, he had talked about how him and his writing partner Noah would like just rewrite scenes like 100 times. You know, they'd be like, let's rewrite the scene. And I was so stressed out. I'm like, don't you get tired of just writing and writing? Don't you run out of things to say? And he said, no, like to us, every scene didn't really matter how you described it or what the character said. It just, you needed to capture an idea. This scene is about this thing and this feeling. And let's just write the best version of the scene to get this feeling across. And it really made me think. I've reflected a lot about that one thing, which seems so obvious and simple. But just that it's all about that feeling that you want to convey and like the methods that you want to convey that feeling in that matters. So vision. I'm into it. I'm into the vision. You do need a vision.
My vision.
Yes. Okay, let's talk real quick about getting work and having longevity in this career.
There's a handful of things that we'll lump together. The odds are against you is one of yours. Similarly, I remember very clearly one time in high school, someone telling me there's only one Steven Spielberg. And then ultimately, maybe lumping it all in together, you have to have rich parents to be a director. It's kind of versions of reasons why, excuses why, you, listener, me, host, Oren, why we're not going to make it, right? This is people projecting onto you of like what you
mean. I remember hearing like a lot of people in show business say something to the effect of, if you're good at anything else, go do that.
Yeah. That one I still buy, actually. Yeah. Wait, or if you can stomach doing anything else. Yeah.
Maybe it's more that. I mean, I feel like I'm better at a lot of things.
There's lots of things. Filmmaking. Yeah.
I think I'm probably a better engineer than a filmmaker, but I'd still rather be a filmmaker.
Yeah. But I think the point of the if you could do anything else is that it's hard, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to accumulate wealth and have work-life balance and all of the things that we complained about on the show.
Take vacations and get health insurance.
Sure. Send your kids to college, all that stuff. We're going to figure all that out. There's only one Steven Spielberg. The odds are against you. Oren, do you ever feel like there are too many directors? I mean, didn't Nikki Weiss say there are too many directors on the show to us?
Yes.
A pair of directors. And an advocate for directors who loves them, no less.
Right. So I think when I think of the odds being against you, that comes from how many people are going for it versus how many people stick with it, right? Like how many people from your graduating class at USC Film School that wanted to be directors, what percentage of them are directors now? If you had to guess, more than 10%?
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm seriously curious.
Like 3%.
Three directors.
No, it's more than that, but I can name them. I can name all of them. Yeah.
So what, like out of 100, like less than 10 are
working directors. So production is 100 kids, and then critical studies, which is what I was in, is like a couple hundred more. I can think of two that have not been on the show. So counting the two that I'm thinking of that weren't on the show, that's six. Seven, if you get me. If you had asked me how many of my fellow classmates had become lawyers, doctors, I was an undergrad, made a career shift and are very successful in a totally different field now, the number's way, way higher, right? Like, to your point, I think it's the long game. Did you stick it out?
Right. But if you really want to do this, by the time you're in this business for 10 years, for 20 years, the odds aren't as bad against you as you think they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's still challenging. It's still a tough business. It's fickle. The trends change every day. You're the most awesome director one year and nobody wants to work with you the next year. But I do think, and I've been reminded of this, like in the people that I'm competing in for commercials of a certain budget level and that certain category. Yeah, maybe there's 800.
50? Oh, no, it's fewer than 800.
No, in the world. I mean, I'm usually competing against, you know, many times I'm competing against directors in Prague, in London, sure. In Brazil. Yeah,
yeah. International as well.
Yeah. So, you know, the people that do comedy, kind of action comedy, 30-second commercials that can write a treatment and interact with an agency and work with a budget and not have an ego, but still make something that's entertaining and funny and interesting. Yeah, it's not, you're not up against tens of thousands of people.
Sure.
You're up against a few hundred people. And that's why, like, a lot of people say, oh, if you knew Unreal Engine and how to work with the volume and do that, like, I'd get you 100 jobs. Because sometimes there's even more jobs than there mm-hmm. are directors.
Sure.
If yeah. you're a real specialist at a certain, that can work at a certain level. So the percentage of people that make it, quote unquote, as filmmakers is incredibly low. It's not because the odds are against them. It's because they didn't stick it out and weren't willing to suffer enough.
Which is where the you have to have rich parents to be a director idea comes from. And like, certainly it's true that having a financial safety net makes it a lot easier to suffer through the things you're describing, certainly.
Yeah. And that's why I think a lot of times we endorse working in the business. Like, you know, a director like Barry Jenkins, who made this movie Medicine for Melancholy that had some good you know, accolades as an indie film. And then he went into being a post supervisor until he made Moonlight, you know. I think Sam Esmail too, who made Mr. Robot and is now, you know, one of the top filmmakers in Hollywood, also went back and forth between kind of other crew jobs and filmmaking. Yes, you can either have rich parents or you can have yeah. other related skills and be willing to do those skills, you know, as yeah. you're working on your
yeah.
directing work.
And I know nearly as many kids who had rich parents who aren't directing as I do directors. So there you go.
I guess what we're saying is you can make it. and I do want to reiterate that obviously Matt and I, you and I, who knows what we know, but we have talked to hundreds of directors about how they made it. And so I think a lot of our view of this industry is via osmosis of the stories we've heard. It's not just what we've seen personally. I guess that's all I have in terms of encouraging people to still care about filmmaking, to pursue their passion.
Filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing.
And directing, yes. And to just shoot it. Okay, so after 400 episodes, Matt, are you ready to do some endorsing?
Unpaid endorsements.
Oren, you're really going to roll your eyes at this one.
Yeah. I'm going to start before you even say it.
I know that I used to really be all about like mixing your media diet up and you have some junk food along with your greens and, you know, you some art films and some trash cinema and some reality TV. And lately I've only been watching reality TV. And this season of Survivor is really good.
Mm.
When was the last time you watched Survivor? Like
1999.
Yeah. 95. Same. My mom watched she's watched every single episode. And The Office, that I am working at, the writer's room, the post department, everybody loves Survivor. It is the closest thing we have to water cooler talk, is like talking about Survivor. And so I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. I got Paramount Plus. I was like, maybe we can start an office pool or whatever. The first few episodes are shaky, but then it's like there's awesome twists and turns. And what's neat about it, the reason I'm endorsing it, besides it being the main thing that I'm watching, is that if you know how competition reality shows are made, or just reality shows in general, the producing is quite transparent. You can see every single thing they're doing, because for the most part, it's game driven. And so they get to make up the rules as they go along. I don't know how much is pre-planned versus how much is reactive to what's happening in the game, but it is incredible to see what the producers do to guarantee drama, plot twists, twists and turns every single day. It's great. It's really fun. And kind of a treat to watch some, this is season 45, right? So they do more than one season a year. They really crank them out. And I guess this is like a new era. You probably aren't familiar with any of the new rules. There's like hidden idols where like they dig around and they find stuff, and there's like different clues where like people are all kind of conniving against each other. People are getting pulled off. They'll go on like a little boat trip and they'll have like secret alliances, all sorts of crazy stuff. It is like the most elaborate board game you've ever played in your life, but it's happening in real time with a bunch of starving people who were, you know, still just eating rice and like trying to start fires and stuff. It's pretty fun. Kaplan, what you got?
Cool. I've got two things. One is a plug-in. Now, I know you and I talked to one of the people from Krotos about this, but I don't know if I've actually endorsed it on the podcast. It's called Place It. It's this plug-in from Soundly, and it's free. I think it's a VST plug-in, which means you can use it in any DAW, like digital audio workstation program, but let's just say you can use it in Premiere and Resolve and Audition and Pro Tools. And it is a tool that lets you place sound in different places. So let's say you want to have somebody yelling from inside the club. You know, you can just put this plugin on it, and you can, I think they have like a outside the club setting preset. They have all these presets, and it's just a really good way to like it. Like, if you know anything about compositing, I think it's like feathering the edges. You know, you take someone on a green screen and you want to put them on a different background. You want to kind of blend the edges of the foreground with the background. And that's what Place It does for audio. You record some Foley, you record some ADR, and you want it to feel like it actually was recorded in this warehouse or in this tiny room or whatever it is. You use this plugin, and it's just really amazing at making it easy to place in a sound effect into a scene.
You use it in Premiere?
I use it in Premiere, yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
It's just, you might have to Google like how to install it, because I think at least you and I probably don't install a lot of audio plugins into Premiere, but it's a VST plugin, and there's some folder you put it in or something. But Place It from Soundly, it's free. The other thing is actually an Instagram video I saw today from this guy. His handle is OMG Adrian. He's like some sort of influencer. He's got like 320,000 followers. I think he made like a Lil Nas X music video. He's a director filmmaker, but he's more of like a filmmaking influencer, I would say. He makes really cool travel videos and cooking videos, but most of his videos that have a lot of views are videos about how he makes his videos. And they're all really short, you know, they're Instagram videos, they're all vertical. But he put out a video, it's called Attention Hacking 101. He talks about how he chooses the music for his vlogs before he records the vlog. And he listens to it as he's writing the script. And then when he goes to record himself talking, he plays it back for himself for like a few beats. And then he stops it, and then he starts talking. And he claims that by speaking in the same cadence as the music, it makes his videos more engaging. And I don't know if it's true or not, but I think it's like an interesting theory. And aside from music videos, I've never really done that. I've never like said, okay, ready here. This is the beat. Now let's do the dialogue, you know, to a non-musical, non-lyrical, non-music video type thing. I don't know. I just thought it was an interesting thing. His name was OMG Adrian, A-D-R-I-A-N on Instagram. And this video he made is Attention Hacking 101. And I don't know. I'm curious what our listeners think. Email us at justshootapod@gmail.com. If you think talking to the beat can subliminally make your videos more engaging, we'd love to hear what you endorse. We'd love to hear if this podcast has meant anything to you over 400 episodes, 8.5 years. And also just like hit us up, you know, tell us what's going on with you. Ask us questions. The odds might be in your favor for us to respond. Please reach out to us, justshootapod@gmail.com, or you can hit us up across all social media. We're at justshootapod. I'm at O Kaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow. This episode is edited and produced by Noah Bayshore. Additional producing by Tyler Small. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.